his chin in the direction of the open door. Patrick sat down beside the owner.
"I'm Detective Ducharme," he said. "Can you tell me what happened?"
The man shook his head.
"It was so fast. She asked to see a pistol, a Smith & Wesson. Said she wanted to keep it in the house for protection. She asked if I had any literature on that model, and when I turned my back to find some, she..."
He shook his head and went silent.
"Where did she get the bullets?"
Patrick asked.
"I didn't sell them to her," the owner said. "She must have had them in her purse."
Patrick nodded.
"You stay here with Officer Rodriguez. I might have some more questions."
Inside the gun shop, there was a spray of blood and brain matter on the right-hand wall. The medical examiner, Gunther Frankenstein, was already bent over the body, lying sideways on the floor.
"How the hell did you get here so fast?"
Patrick asked. Gunther shrugged.
"I was in town at a baseball card collector's show."
Patrick squatted beside him.
"You collect baseball cards?"
"Well, I can't very well collect livers, can I?"
He glanced at Patrick.
"We really have to stop meeting like this. I wish."
"Pretty self-explanatory," Gunther said. "She stuck the gun in her mouth and pulled the trigger."
Patrick noticed the purse on the glass counter. He rifled through it, found a box of ammunition and the Walmart receipt for them. Then he opened the woman's wallet to find her ID, just at the same time Gunther rolled the body over. Even with the gunshot residue blackening her features, Patrick recognized her before he saw her name. He'd spoken to Yvette Harvey. He'd been the one to tell her that her only child, a daughter with Down syndrome, had not survived the shooting at Sterling High. Indirectly, Patrick realized, Peter Houghton's casualty count was still rising.
"Just because someone collects guns doesn't mean they intend to use them," Peter said, scowling.
It was unseasonably warm for late March, a freakish 85 degrees, and the air conditioning at the jail was broken. The inmates were walking around in their boxers. The guards were all on edge. The HVAC patrol, which had been called in on the pretense of humane incarceration, was working so slowly that Jordan figured they'd master their trade just in time for the snow to start falling again outside. He'd been sitting in a sweatbox of a conference room with Peter for over 2 hours now and felt as if he'd soaked through every last fiber of his suit. He wanted to quit. He wanted to go home and tell Selena that he never should have taken this case, and then he wanted to drive with his family to the 18 stingy miles of beach that New Hampshire was blessed with and jump fully clothed into the frigid Atlantic. Dying of hypothermia couldn't be any worse than the slow kill Diana Levin and the DA's office had in store for him in court. Whatever small hope Jordan had kindled by discovering a valid defense, albeit one that had never been used before a judge, had been steadily eroded in the weeks following the hearing by the discovery that had arrived from the DA's office, stacks of paperwork, photos, and evidence. Given all this information, it was hard to imagine a jury caring why Peter had killed 10 people, just that he had. Jordan pinched the bridge of his nose.
"You were collecting guns," he repeated. "I suppose you just happened to be storing them under your bed until you could get a nice glass display case."
"Don't you believe me?
People who collect guns do not hide them. People who collect guns do not have hit lists with photos circled."
Perspiration beaded on Peter's forehead, around the collar of his prison uniform, and his mouth tightened. Jordan leaned forward.
"Who's the girl that got erased?"
"What girl?"
"In the photos. You circled her, and then you wrote, 'Let live.'"
Peter looked away.
"She's just someone I used to know."
"What's her name?"
"Josie Cormier."
Peter hesitated, then faced Jordan again.
She's okay, right?
Cormier, Jordan thought. The only Cormier he knew was the judge sitting on Peter's case.
It couldn't be.
Why? He asked. Did you hurt her? Peter shook his head.
That's a loaded question.
Had something happened here that Jordan didn't know about?
Was she your girlfriend?
Peter smiled, but it didn't reach his eyes.
No.
Jordan had been in Judge Cormier's district court a few times. He liked her. She was tough, but she was fair. In fact, she was the best judge Peter could have drawn for his case. The alternative Superior Court justice was Judge Wagner, who was a very old, prosecution-biased judge. Josie Cormier hadn't been a victim of the shooting, but that wasn't the only scenario that would compromise Judge Cormier as the justice for the trial. Suddenly, Jordan was thinking of witness tampering, of the 100 things that could go wrong. He was wondering how he could find out what Josie Cormier knew about the shooting without anyone else learning that he'd been looking into it. He was wondering what she knew that might help Peter's case.
"Have you talked to her since you've been in here?" Jordan said. "If I'd talked to her, would I be asking you if she was okay?"
"Well, don't talk to her," Jordan instructed. "Don't talk to anyone except me."
"That's like talking to a brick wall,"
Peter muttered. "You know, I could rattle off 1,000 things I'd rather be doing than sitting with you in a conference room that's as hot as hell." Peter narrowed his eyes.
"Then why don't you go do some of them? You don't listen to a word I say anyway."
"I listen to every word, Peter. I listen to it, and then I think about the boxes of evidence the DA dropped at my door, all of which make you look like a cold-blooded killer. I hear you tell me you were collecting guns, like you're some kind of Civil War buff." Peter flinched.
"Fine. You want to know if I was going to use the guns?" "Yeah, I was. I planned it. I ran through the whole thing in my head. I worked out the details, down to the last second. I was going to kill the person I hated the most. But then I didn't get to do it.
Those 10 people
just got in the way," Peter said.
"Then who were you trying to kill?" On the opposite side of the room, the air conditioner suddenly choked to life. Peter turned away.
"Me," he said.
One year before.
"I still don't think this is a good idea," Lewis said as he opened the back door of the van.
The dog, Dozer, was lying on his side, fighting to breathe.
"You heard the vet," Lacey said, stroking the retriever's head.
"Good dog." They'd gotten him when Peter was 3. Now, at 12, his kidneys had shut down. Keeping him alive with medications was only for their benefit, not his. It was too hard to imagine their house without the dog padding through its halls.
"I wasn't talking about putting him down," Lewis clarified. "I was talking about bringing everyone along."
The boys fell out of the back of the van like heavy stones. They squinted in the sunlight, hunched their shoulders. Their broad backs made Lacey think of oak trees that tapered to the ground. They both had the same habit of turning in their left foot when they walked. She wished they could have seen how very alike they were.
"I can't believe you dragged us here," Joey said.
Peter kicked at the gravel in the parking lot.
"This sucks."
"Language," Lacey warned. "And as for us all being here, I cannot believe you'd be selfish enough to not want to say goodbye to a member of the family."
"We could have said goodbye at home,"
Joey muttered. Lacey put her hands on her hips.
"Death is a part of life. I'd want to be surrounded by people I love when it's my time, too."
She waited for Lewis to haul Dozer into his arms, then closed the hatch of the door. Lacey had requested the last appointment of the day so that the doctor wouldn't be rushed. They sat alone in the waiting room, the dog draped like a blanket over Lewis's legs. Joey picked up a Sports Illustrated magazine from 3 years ago and started to read. Peter folded his arms and stared up at the ceiling.
"Let's all talk about our best dozer memory," Lacey said.
Lewis sighed.
"For God's sake."
"This is lame," Joey added.
"For me," Lacey said, as if they hadn't even spoken, "it was when Dozer was a puppy, and I found him on the dining room table with his head stuck inside the turkey."
She stroked the dog's head. "That was the year we had soup for Thanksgiving."
Joey slapped the magazine back on the end table and sighed. Marcia, the vet's assistant, was a woman with a long braid that reached past her hips. Lacey had delivered her twin sons 5 years ago.
"Hi, Lacey," she said,
and she came right up and folded her in her arms.
"You okay?"
The thing about death, Lacey knew, was that it robbed you of your vocabulary for comfort. Marcia walked up to Dozer and rubbed him behind the ears.
"Did you want to wait out here?"
"Yes," Joey mouthed toward Peter.
"We're all coming in," Lacey said firmly.
They followed Marcia into one of the treatment rooms and settled Dozer on the examination table. He scrabbled for purchase, his claws clicking against the metal.
"That's a good boy," Marcia said.
Lewis and the boys filed into the room, standing against the wall like a police lineup. When the vet walked in, bearing his hypodermic, they shrank back even further.
"Would you like to help hold him?" the vet asked.
Lacey moved forward, nodding, and settled her arms around Marcia's.
"Well, Dozer, you put up a fine fight," the vet said.
He turned to the boys.
"He won't feel this."
"What is it?"
Lewis asked, staring at the needle.
"A combination of chemicals that relax the muscles and terminate nerve transmission. And without nerve transmission, there's no thought, no feeling, no movement. It's a bit like drifting off to sleep."
He felt around for a vein in the dog's leg, while Marcia kept Dozer steady. He injected the solution and rubbed Dozer's head. The dog took a deeper breath and then stopped moving. Marcia stepped away, leaving Dozer in Lacey's arms.
"We'll give you a minute," she said,
and she and the vet left the room. Lacey was used to holding new life in her hands, not feeling it pass from the body in her arms. It was just another transition, pregnancy to birth, child to adult, life to death. But there was something about letting go of the family pet that was even more difficult, as if it were silly to have feelings this strong for something that wasn't human, as if admitting that you loved a dog, one that was always underfoot and scratching the leather and tracking mud into the house, as much as you loved your biological children, were foolish. And yet, this was the dog who had stoically and silently allowed 2-year-old Peter to ride him like a horse around the yard. This was the dog who had barked the house down when Joey had fallen asleep on the couch while his dinner was cooking until the entire oven was on fire. This was the dog who sat beneath the desk on Lacey's feet in the dead of winter as she answered email, sharing the heat of his pale, pinkened belly. She bent over the dog's body and began to weep, quietly at first, and then with loud sobs that made Joey turn away and Lewis wince.
"Do something,"
she heard Joey say, his voice thick and ropey. She felt a hand on her shoulder and assumed it was Lewis, but then Peter began to speak.
"When he was a puppy," Peter said, "the time we went to pick him out from the litter. All his brothers and sisters were trying to climb over the pen, and he was on the top of the stairs, and he looked at us and tripped and fell down them."
Lacey raised her face and stared at him.
"That's my best memory," Peter said.
Lacey had always considered herself lucky to have somehow received a child who was not the cookie-cutter American boy, one who was sensitive and emotional, and so in tune with what others felt and thought. She let go of her fist grip on the dog's fur and opened her arms so that Peter could move into them. Unlike Joey, who was already taller than her and more muscular than Louis, Peter still fit into her embrace. Even that square span of his shoulder blades, so expansive underneath a cotton shirt, seemed more delicate underneath her hands. Unfinished and rough-hewn, a man still waiting to happen.
If only you could keep them that way, cast in amber, never growing up.
At every school concert and play in Josie's life, she'd had only one parent in the audience. Her mother, to her credit, had rearranged court dates so that she could watch Josie be plaque in the school dental hygiene play, or hear her five-note solo in the Christmas chorale. There were other kids who also had single parents, the ones who came from divorced families, for example. But Josie was the only person in the school who had never met her father. When she was little and her second-grade class was making necktie cards for Father's Day, she was relegated to sitting in the corner with the girl whose dad had died prematurely at age 42 of cancer. Like any curious kid, she had asked her mother about this when she was growing up. Josie wanted to know why her parents weren't married anymore. She hadn't expected to hear that they were never married.
"He wasn't the marrying type," she'd told Josie, and Josie hadn't understood why that also meant he wasn't the type to send a present for his daughter's birthday, or to invite her to his home for a week during the summer, or to even call to hear her voice. This year, she was supposed to be taking biology, and she was already nervous about the unit on genetics. Josie didn't know if her father had brown eyes or blue ones, if he had curly hair or freckles or six toes. Her mother had shrugged off Josie's concerns. "Surely there's someone in your class who's adopted," she said. "You know 50% more about your background than they do." This is what Josie had pieced together about her father. His name was Logan Rourke. He'd been a teacher at the law school her mother had attended. His hair had gone white prematurely, but, her mother assured her, in a cool, not creepy way. He was 10 years older than her mother, which meant he was 50. He had long fingers and played the piano. He couldn't whistle. Not quite enough to fill a standard biography, if you asked Josie. Not that anyone ever bothered to. She was sitting in bio lab next to Courtney. Josie ordinarily wouldn't have picked Courtney as a lab partner. She wasn't the brightest bulb in the chandelier, but that didn't seem to matter. Mrs. Aracourt was the teacher advisor to the cheerleaders, and Courtney was one of those. No matter how skimpy their lab reports turned out, they still always managed to get A's. A dissected cat brain was sitting on the front desk next to Mrs. Aracourt. It smelled of formaldehyde and looked like roadkill, which would have been bad enough. But in addition, last period had been lunchtime. "That thing," Courtney had shuddered, "is going to make me even more bulimic."
Josie was trying not to look at it while she worked on her class project. Each student had been given a wireless-enabled Dell laptop to surf the net for examples of humane animal research. So far, Josie had cataloged a primate study being done by an allergy pill manufacturer where monkeys were made asthmatic and then cured, and another one that involved SIDS and puppies. She hit a browser button by mistake and got a home page for the Boston Globe. Splashed across the screen was election coverage, the race between the incumbent district attorney and his challenger, the dean of students at Harvard Law School, a man named Logan Rourke. Butterflies rose inside Josie's chest. There couldn't be more than one, could there? She squinted, leaning closer to the screen,
But the photograph was grainy, and there was a sunlight glare.
"What's wrong with you?" Courtney whispered.
Josie shook her head and closed the cover of her laptop, as if it, too, could hold fast to this secret. He never used a urinal. Even if Peter just had to pee, he didn't want to do it standing next to some gargantuan 12th grader who might make a comment about, well, the fact that he was a puny 9th grader, particularly in his nether regions. Instead, he'd go into a stall and close the door for privacy. He liked to read the bathroom walls. One of the stalls had a running series of knock-knock jokes. Others blurted the names of girls who gave blowjobs. There was one scribble that Peter found his eye veering toward repeatedly. "Trey Wilkins is a faggot." He didn't know Trey Wilkins, didn't think he was even a student at Sterling High anymore. But Peter wondered if Trey had come into the bathroom and used the stalls to pee, too. Peter had left English in the middle of a pop quiz on grammar. He truly didn't think that in the grand scheme of life, it was going to matter whether or not an adjective modified a noun or a verb or just dropped off the face of the earth, which is what he was sincerely hoping would happen before he had to go back to class. He had already done his business in the bathroom. Now he was just wasting time. If he failed this quiz, it would be the second in a row. It wasn't even his parents' anger that Peter was worried about. It was the way they'd look at him, disappointed that he hadn't turned out more like Joey. He heard the door of the bathroom open and the busy slice of hallway noise that trailed on the heels of the two kids who entered. Peter ducked down, scanning beneath the door stalls. Nikes.
"I'm sweating like a pig," said one voice.
The second kid laughed.
"That's because you're a lardass."
"Yeah, right. I could beat you on a basketball court with one hand tied behind my back."
Peter could hear a faucet running, water splashing.
"Hey, you're getting me soaked."
"Ah, much better,"
the first voice said.
"At least now I'm not sweating. Hey, check out my hair. I look like Alfalfa."
"Who?"
"What are you, retarded? The kid from the Little Rascals with the cowlick thing on the back of his head." "Actually, you look like a total fag."
"You know,"
more laughter,
"I do sort of look like Peter."
As soon as Peter heard his name, his heart thumped hard. He slid open the bolt in the stall door and stepped outside. Standing in front of the bank of sinks was a football player he knew only by sight, and his own brother. Joey's hair was dripping wet, standing up on the back of his head the way Peter's sometimes did, even when he tried to slick it down with his mother's hair gel. Joey flicked a glance his way.
"Get lost, freak," he ordered,
and Peter hurried out of the bathroom, wondering if that was even possible when you'd been missing most of your life. The two men standing in front of Alex's bench shared a duplex, but hated each other. Arliss Undergroot was a sheetrock installer with tattoos up and down both arms, a shaved head, and enough piercings in his head to have set off the metal detectors at the courthouse. Rodney Eakes was a vegan bank teller with a prized record collection of original cast recordings from Broadway shows. Arliss lived downstairs, Rodney lived upstairs. A few months back, Rodney had brought home a bale of hay, planning to use it for mulching his organic garden, but he never got around to it, and the hay bale remained on Arliss's porch. Arliss asked Rodney to get rid of the hay, but Rodney hadn't moved fast enough. So one night, Arliss and his girlfriend cut the twine and spread the hay out over the front lawn. Rodney called the police, and they had actually arrested Arliss on the grounds of criminal mischief, legal speak for destroying a bale of hay. "Why are the taxpayers of New Hampshire shelling out money for a case like this to be tried in court?" Alex asked. The police prosecutor shrugged.
"The chief asked me to pursue it," he said, but then he rolled his eyes.
He had already proven that Arliss had taken the bale of hay and spread it over the lawn. The burden of proof fulfilled. But a conviction in this case would mean Arliss would have a criminal record for the rest of his life. He might have been a lousy neighbor, but he didn't deserve that. Alex turned to the prosecutor. How much did the victim pay for that bale of hay?
$4, Your Honor.
Then she faced the defendant. Do you have $4 with you today? Arliss nodded. Good. Your case is filed without a finding, conditional upon your paying the victim. Take $4 out of your wallet and give it to the police officer over there, who will bring it to Mr. Eakes in the back of the courtroom. She glanced at her clerk. We're taking a 15-minute recess. In chambers, Alex stripped off her robe and grabbed a pack of cigarettes. She took the back stairs to the bottom floor of the building and lit up, inhaling deeply. There were days when she was proud of her job, and then there were others, like today, when she wondered why she even bothered. She found Liz, the groundskeeper, raking the lawn in front of the courthouse.
I brought you a cigarette, Alex said.
What's wrong?
How did you know something was wrong?
Because you've been working here for how many years and you've never brought me a cigarette?
Alex leaned against the tree, watching leaves as bright as jewels catch in the tines of Liz's rake.
I just wasted 3 hours on a case that never should have made it to a courthouse. I have a splitting headache, and I ran out of toilet paper in the bathroom and chambers and had to call the clerk in to get me a roll for maintenance.
Liz glanced up at the tree as a gust of wind sent a new score of leaves onto the raked grass.
Alex, she said, can I ask you a question?
Sure.
When was the last time you got laid?
Alex turned, her mouth dropping open.
What does that have to...
Most people who go to work spend their time wondering how long till they get back home to do whatever it is they really want to do. For you, it's the other way around.
That's not true. Josie and I...
What did you two do for fun this weekend?
Alex plucked a leaf and shredded it. In the past 3 years, Josie's social calendar had become crammed with phone calls and sleepovers and packs of kids going to a movie or hanging out in someone's basement lair. This weekend, Josie had gone shopping with Haley Weaver, a junior who'd just gotten her driver's license. Alex had written 2 decisions and cleaned out the fruit and vegetable drawers in her refrigerator.
I'm setting you up on a blind date, Liz said.
There were a number of business establishments in Sterling that hired teenagers for after-school employment. After his first summer at Quick Copy, Peter had deduced that this was because the jobs mostly sucked and they couldn't find anyone else to do them. He was responsible for photocopying most of the course material for Sterling College, which professors brought in. He knew how to shrink a document down to 1/32nd of its original size and how to add toner. When customers paid, he liked to guess what size bill they were going to pull out of their wallets just by the way they dressed or wore their hair. College kids always used 20s. Moms with strollers whipped out a credit card. Professors used crumpled singles. The reason he was working was because he needed a new computer with a better graphics card so that he could do some of the gaming design he and Derek had been into lately. It never failed to amaze Peter how you could take a seemingly senseless string of commands and, magic, it would become a knight or a sword or a castle on the screen. He liked the very concept that something the ordinary person might dismiss as gibberish was actually vibrant and eye-catching, if you knew how to look at it. Last week, when his boss said he'd hired another high school student, Peter had become so nervous that he actually had to lock himself in the bathroom for 20 minutes until he could act like it was no big deal. As stupid and boring as this job was, it was a haven. Peter was alone here most of the afternoon. He didn't have to worry about crossing paths with the cool kids. But if Mr. Cargrew was hiring someone else from Sterling High, then that person knew who Peter was. And even if the kid wasn't part of the popular crowd, the copy center would no longer be a comfortable place. Peter would have to think twice about what he said or did, because otherwise it would become fodder for rumors around school. To Peter's great surprise, however, his co-worker turned out to be Josie Cormier. She had walked in behind Mr. Cargrew. "This is Josie," he said, by way of introduction. "You two know each other?" "Sort of," Josie had replied, as Peter answered, "Yeah." "Peter will show you the ropes," Mr. Cargrew said, and then he left to go play golf. Occasionally, when Peter walked down the hall in school and he saw Josie with her new group of friends, he didn't recognize her. She dressed differently now, in jeans that showed off her flat belly and a rainbow of T-shirts layered one over the other. She wore makeup that made her eyes look enormous. And a little sad, he sometimes thought, but he doubted she knew that. The last major conversation he'd had with Josie had been 5 years ago, when they were in sixth grade. He had been certain that the real Josie would come out of this fog of popularity and realize that the people she was hanging around with were about as scintillating as cardboard cutouts. He was sure that as soon as they started ripping on other people, she'd come back to Peter. "Oh my God," she would say, and they'd laugh about her journey to the underworld. "What was I thinking?" But Josie never came crawling back to him, and then he started to hang out with Derek from the soccer team, and by the time he was in seventh grade, he found it really hard to believe that once he and Josie had spent 2 weeks coming up with a secret handshake that no one else would ever be able to duplicate. "So," Josie had said that first day, as if she'd never met him before, "what do we do?" They had been working together for a week now. Well, not together. It was more like they were doing a dance, punctuated with the sighs and throaty grumbles of the copiers and the shrill ring of the telephone. Mostly, if they spoke, it was informational. "Do we have any more toner for the color copier? How much do I charge someone to receive a fax here?" This afternoon, Peter was photocopying articles for a psychology course at the college. Every now and then, as the pages whipped through the automatic collating machine, he'd see brain scans of schizophrenics, bright pink circles at the frontal lobes that reproduced in shades of gray. "What's that word you use when you call something by its brand name instead of what it really is?" Josie was stapling together another job. She shrugged. "Like Xerox," Peter said. "Or Kleenex." "Jell-O," Josie answered after a moment.
"Google."
Josie glanced up.
"Band-Aid," she said.
"Q-tip."
She thought for a second, a grin spreading over her face.
"FedEx. Wiffle ball."
Peter smiled.
"Rollerblade. Frisbee.
Crockpot.
That's not..."
"Go look it up," Josie said.
"Jacuzzi. Post-it.
Magic marker.
Ping pong."
By now, they'd both stopped working. They were standing next to each other, laughing, when the bell over the door chimed. Matt Royston walked into the store. He was wearing a Sterling hockey cap. Even though the season wouldn't start for another month, everyone knew he would be tapped for varsity, even as a freshman. Peter, who'd been reveling in the miracle that here was Josie again, like she used to be, watched her turn to Matt. Her cheeks pinkened. Her eyes leaped like the brightest part of a flame.
"What are you doing here?"
He leaned against the counter.
"Is that how you treat all your customers?
Do you need something copied?" Matt's mouth cocked up in a grin.
"No way. I'm an original."
He glanced around the store.
"So this is where you work?"
"No, I just come here for the free caviar and champagne," Josie joked. Peter watched this exchange from behind the counter. He waited for Josie to tell Matt that she was in the middle of doing something, which might not necessarily be true, but they had been having a conversation. Sort of.
When do you get off?
Matt asked.
5.
Some of us are going over to Drew's tonight to hang out.
Is that an invitation?
She said, and Peter noticed that when she smiled, really hard, she had a dimple he'd never noticed before. Or maybe she just hadn't smiled that way around him.
Do you want it to be?
Matt answered.
Peter walked toward the counter. We have to get back to work, he blurted out.
Matt's eyes flicked over Peter.
Stop looking at me, homo.
Josie moved so that her body was blocking Peter's view of Matt.
What time?
7.
I'll see you over there, she said.
Matt wrapped his hands against the counter.
Cool,
he replied, and he walked out of the store.
Saran wrap, Peter said. Vaseline.
Josie turned to him, confused.
What? Oh, right.
She picked up the materials she'd been stapling, stacked a few more packets on top of each other, aligned their edges. Peter added paper to the machine that was working on his job.
Do you like him?
He asked.
Matt? I guess. Not like that, Peter said.
He pressed the copy button, watched the machine begin to birth 100 identical babies. When Josie didn't answer, he went to stand next to her at the sorting table. He gathered a packet of papers in his hands and stapled it, then handed it to her.
What does it feel like?
He asked.
What does what feel like?
Peter thought for a moment.
Being at the top.
Josie reached across him for another packet of material and fed it into the stapler. She did 3 of these, and Peter was certain that she was going to ignore him, but then she spoke.
Like if you take 1 wrong step, she said, you're going to fall.
When she said that, Peter could hear a note in her voice that was like a lullaby. He could vividly remember sitting on Josie's driveway in the heat of July, trying to make a fire with sawdust, sunlight, and his glasses. He could hear her yelling over her shoulder as they ran home from school, daring Peter to catch up. He saw a faint flush paint her face and realized that the Josie who used to be his friend was still there, trapped inside several cocoons, like one of those Russian nesting dolls that hides another and another until you reach the one that fits snug in the palm of your hand. If he could just somehow make her remember those things, too. Maybe being popular wasn't what had made Josie start hanging out with Matt and company. Maybe it was just because she'd forgotten that she liked hanging out with Peter. From the corner of his eye, he looked at Josie. She was biting her lower lip, concentrating hard on getting the staple straight. Peter wished he knew how to be as easy and natural as Matt, but all his life he'd always seemed to laugh just a little too loud or too late, to be oblivious to the fact that he was the one being laughed at. He didn't know how to be anyone except who he'd always been, so he took a deep breath and told himself that not too long ago that had been good enough for Josie anyway.
Hey, he said, check this out.
He walked into the adjoining office, the one where Mr. Cargrew kept a picture of his wife and kids and his computer, which was firmly off-limits and password-encoded. Josie followed him and stood behind the chair as Peter sat down. He keyed a few strokes, and suddenly the screen opened up for access.
How did you do that?
Josie asked. Peter shrugged.
I've been playing around with computers a lot. I hacked into Cargrew's last week. I don't think we should... Wait.
Peter picked his way through the computer until he reached a well-hidden file of downloads and opened up the first porn site.
Is that a dwarf?
Josie murmured.
And a donkey?
Peter tilted his head.
I thought it was a really big cat.
Either way, it's totally gross. She shuddered.
Ugh, how am I gonna take a paycheck from that guy's hand now?
Then she looked down at Peter.
What else can you do with that computer?
Anything, he bragged.
Like, hack into other places? Schools and stuff?
Sure,
Peter said, although he didn't really know about that. He was just starting to learn about encryption and how to make wormholes through it.
What about finding an address?
Piece of cake,
Peter answered.
Whose?
Someone totally random, she said, and she leaned over him to type. He could smell her hair, apples, and felt the press of her shoulder against his. Peter closed his eyes, waiting for lightning to strike. Josie was pretty, and she was a girl, and yet he felt nothing. Was that because she was too familiar, like a sister, or because she wasn't a he?
Stop looking at me, homo.
He didn't tell Josie this, but when he'd first found Mr. Cargrew's porn site, he'd found himself staring at the guys, not the girls. Did that mean he was attracted to them? Then again, he'd looked at the animals, too. Couldn't it just have been curiosity? Comparison, even, between the men and him? What if it turned out that Matt, and everyone else, was right? Josie clicked on the mouse a few times until the screen was filled with an article from the Boston Globe.
There,
she said, pointing.
That guy.
Peter squinted at the caption.
Who's Logan Rourke?
Who cares, Josie said. Someone who looks like he has an unlisted address, anyway.
He did. But then, Peter figured that anyone running for public office probably was smart enough to take their personal information out of the phone book. It took him 10 minutes to figure out that Logan Rourke had worked for Harvard Law School, and another 15 to hack into the human resources files there.
Ta-da,
Peter said.
He lives in Lincoln. Conant Road.
He looked over his shoulder and saw his smile spread, contagious, over Josie's face. She stared at the screen for a long moment.
You are good, she said.
Economists, it was often said, knew the price of everything and the value of nothing. Lewis considered this as he opened up the enormous file on his office computer, the World Values Survey. Gathered by Norwegian social scientists, here was data collected from hundreds of thousands of people around the world, an endless array of details. Simple ones, like age, gender, birth order, weight, religion, marital status, number of children, and more complex accounts, like political views and religious affiliations. The survey had even considered time allocation, how long a person spent at work, how often he went to church, how many times a week he had sex, and with how many partners. What would have seemed tedious to most people was, to Lewis, like a roller coaster ride. When you started to sort out the patterns in data this massive, you didn't know where you'd twist or turn, how steep the fall, or how soaring the heights. He'd examined these numbers often enough to know that he'd be able to quickly crank out a paper for next week's conference. It didn't have to be perfect. The gathering was small, and his higher-ranking peers wouldn't be present. He could always take whatever he eked out now and polish it later for publication in an academic journal. The focus of his paper involved putting a price on the variables of happiness. Everyone always said that money bought happiness, but how much? Did income have a direct or causal effect on happiness? Were happier people more successful in their jobs, or were they given a higher wage because they were happier people? Happiness wasn't limited to one's income, either. Was marriage more valuable in America or Europe? Did sex matter?
Why did churchgoers report higher levels of happiness than non-churchgoers? Why did Scandinavians, who scored high on the happiness scale, have one of the highest suicide rates in the world? As Lewis said about picking through the variables of the survey using multivariate regression analysis on Stata, he thought about the value he'd have put on the variables of his own happiness. What monetary compensation would have made up for not having a woman like Lacey in his life? For not getting a tenured position at Sterling College? For his health? It didn't do the average person much good to know that marital status was associated with a 0.07 level increase in happiness, with a standard error of 0.02%. On the other hand, tell the average Joe that being married had the same effect on overall happiness as an additional $100,000 a year, and it put things into perspective. These were the findings he'd reached so far. Number one, higher income was associated with higher happiness, but in diminishing returns. For example, someone who made $50,000 reported being happier than the man with a salary of $25,000, but the incremental gain in happiness that came from getting a raise from $50,000 to $100,000 was much less. Number two, in spite of material improvements, happiness is flat over time. Relative income might be more important than absolute income gains. Number three. Well-being was greatest among women, married people, the highly educated, and those whose parents didn't divorce. Number four. Women's happiness was declining over time, possibly because they'd reached greater equality with men in the labor market. Number five. Blacks in the U.S. were much less happy than whites, but their life satisfaction was on the upswing. Number six. Calculations indicated that reparation for being unemployed would take $60,000 per year. Reparation for being black would take $30,000 per year. Reparation for being widowed or separated would take $100,000 per year. There was a game Lewis used to play with himself after the kids were born, when he was feeling so ridiculously lucky that surely tragedy was bound to strike. He'd lie in bed and force himself to choose what he was first willing to lose: his marriage, his job, a child. He would wonder how much a man could take before he reduced himself to nothing. He closed the data window and stared at the screensaver on his computer. It was a picture taken when the kids were 8 and 10 at a petting zoo in Connecticut. Joey had hoisted his brother up, piggyback, and they were grinning, with a striated pink sunset in the background. Moments later, a deer, "deer on steroids," Lacey had said, had knocked Joey's feet out from beneath him, and both boys had fallen and dissolved into tears. But that was not the way Lewis liked to recall it. Happiness wasn't just what you reported. It was also how you chose to remember. There was one other finding he'd cataloged. Happiness was U-shaped. People were happiest when they were very young and very old. The trough came, roughly, when you hit your 40s. Or in other words, Lewis thought with relief, this is as bad as it gets. Although Josie got A's in math and liked the subject, it was the one grade she had to fight for. Numbers didn't come easily to her, although she could reason with logic and write an essay without breaking a sweat. In this, she supposed, she was like her mother. Or possibly her father. Mr. McCabe, their math teacher, was walking through the rows of desks, tossing a tennis ball against the ceiling and singing a bastardized Don McLean song.
Bye, bye, what's the value of pie? Gotta fidget with the digits till this class has gone by. Them ninth graders were working hard with a sigh, saying, Mr. McCabe, come on, why? Oh, Mr. McCabe, come on, why?
Josie erased a coordinate from the graph paper in front of her. We're not even using pi, one kid said. The teacher whirled around and tossed the tennis ball so that it bounced on the boy's desk. Andrew, I'm so glad to see you woke up in time to notice that.
Does this count as a pop quiz?
No. Maybe I should go on TV, Mr. McCabe mused. Is there a math idol?
God, I hope not,
Matt muttered from the desk behind Josie. He poked her shoulder, and she pushed her paper to the upper left corner of her desk because she knew he could see the homework answers better there. This week they were working on graphing. In addition to a bazillion assignments that made you take data and force it into bar graphs and charts, each student had had to create and present a graph of something near and dear to them. Mr. McCabe left 10 minutes at the end of each class period for the presentation. Yesterday, Matt had shown off a graph of relative age of hockey players in the NHL. Josie, who was presenting hers tomorrow, had polled her friends to see if there was a ratio between the number of hours you spent doing your homework and your grade point average. Today was Peter Houghton's turn. She had seen him carrying his graph into school, a rolled-up piece of poster board.
Well, look at that, Mr. McCabe said. Turns out we are talking about pie. The other one, that is.
Peter's graph was a pie chart. It had been clearly shaded with colors, and computer labels identified each section. The title at the top of the chart said, Popularity.
Whenever you're ready, Peter, Mr. McCabe said.
Peter looked a little bit like he was going to pass out, but then Peter always looked like that. Since Josie had started working at the copy shop, they'd been talking again, but, by unwritten rule, only outside of school. Inside was different, a fishbowl where anything you said and did was being watched by everyone else. When they were kids, Peter had never seemed to notice when he was drawing attention just by being himself. Like when he'd decide to speak Martian during recess, for example. Josie supposed that the flip side of this, the optimistic angle, was that Peter never tried to be like anyone else. She couldn't lay claim to that herself. Peter cleared his throat.
My graph is about status in this school. My statistical sample came from the 24 students in this class. You can see here, he pointed at one wedge of the pie, that a little less than a third of the class are popular.
Shaded violet, the color of popularity, were 7 wedges, each sporting a different classmate's name. There was Matt and Drew, a few girls who hung out at lunchtime with Josie, but the class clown was also lumped in that group, Josie noticed, and the new kid who'd transferred from Washington, D.C.
Over here are the geeks, Peter said, and Josie could see the names of the class brain and the girl who played tuba in the marching band. The largest group is what I call normal, and roughly 5% are outcasts.
Everyone had grown quiet. This was one of those moments, Josie realized, when the guidance counselors would get called in to give everyone a booster shot of tolerance for differences. She could see Mr. McCabe's brow furrow like origami as he tried to figure out how to turn Peter's presentation into an after-school special moment. She saw Drew and Matt grinning at each other, and most of all, she noticed Peter, who was blissfully unaware that all hell was about to break loose. Mr. McCabe cleared his throat.
You know, Peter, maybe you and I should...
Matt's hand shot up.
Mr. McCabe, I have a question.
Matt.
No, seriously.
I can't read that skinny piece of the pie chart, the orange one.
Oh, Peter said.
That's a bridge, you know, a person who can fit into more than one category, or who hangs out with different kinds of people, like Josie.
He turned to her, beaming, and Josie felt everyone's eyes on her, a hail of arrows. She curled over her desk like a midnight rose, letting her hair fall over her face. To be honest, she was used to being stared at. Walk anywhere with Courtney, and it was bound to happen. But there was a difference between people looking at you because they wanted to be like you, and people looking at you because your misfortune brought them one rung higher. At the very least, kids would remember that once, Josie had been an outcast who used to hang out with Peter. Or they'd assume that Peter had some weird crush on her, which was just sick, and she'd never hear the end of it. A murmur ran through the classroom like an electric shock. "Freak," someone whispered, and Josie prayed that they were not talking about her. Because there was a god, the bell rang.
"So Josie," Drew said, "are you the Tobin or the Golden Gate?"
Josie tried to stuff her books into her backpack, but they scattered to the ground, pages splayed.
"London," John Eberhard snickered. "Look, she's falling down."
By now, someone in her math class had surely told someone else down the hall what had happened. Josie would hear laughter following her like a kite's tail for that whole day, maybe even longer. She realized that someone was trying to help her pick up her books, and then, one beat later, that this someone was Peter.
"Don't," Josie said, holding up a hand, a force field that stopped Peter in his tracks. "Don't ever talk to me again, all right?"
In the hallway, she turned corners blindly until she found the little alley that led to the woodshop. Josie had been so naive, thinking that once she belonged, she was firmly entrenched. But in only existed because someone had drawn a line in the sand so that everyone else was out. And that line changed constantly. You might find yourself, through no fault of your own, suddenly standing on the wrong side. What Peter hadn't grasped was how fragile popularity was. Here was the irony. She wasn't a bridge at all. She'd completely crossed over to become part of her group. She'd excluded other people to get to where she so badly wanted to be. Why would those kids ever welcome her back?
"Hey."
At the sound of Matt's voice, Josie drew in a sharp breath.
"Just so you know, I'm not friends with him."
"Well, actually, he's right about you."
Josie blinked at him. She had witnessed firsthand Matt's cruelty. How he'd shoot rubber bands at ESL students who didn't know the words to report him to the faculty. How he called one overweight girl the walking earthquake. How he'd hide a shy kid's math textbook in order to watch him freak out, thinking it was lost. It was funny then, because it hadn't been about Josie. But being the object of his humiliation felt like a slap. She'd thought, mistakenly, that hanging with the right crowd granted her immunity, but that turned out to be a joke. They'd cut you down anyway, as long as it made them seem funnier, cooler, different from you. Seeing Matt with that grin on his face, as if he'd thought she was a total joke all along, hurt even more, because she'd considered him a friend. Well, to be honest, sometimes she wished for even more than that. When a fringe of hair fell over his eyes and his smile lit as slowly as a fuse, she went totally monosyllabic. But Matt had that effect on everyone, even Courtney, who'd gone out with him in sixth grade for 2 weeks.
"I never thought anything the homo said would be worth listening to, but bridges take you from one place to another," Matt said. "And that's what you do to me."
He took Josie's hand, pressed it up against his chest. His heart was beating so hard she could feel it, as if possibility were something you might cup in your palm. She looked up at him, keeping her eyes wide open as he leaned in to kiss her, so that she would not miss a single, startling moment.